Hello, everyone. My name is Lisa Cronin-Smith from the Talking Information Center. Today's Monday, August 24th, and I will be reading the BBC News, BBC Live. Half my business will be gone. Firms in Canada and U.S. fear trade war. Business owners in both countries fear a trade war. Cindy Baldassi relies on American buyers to keep her stone and glass jewelry company going. Some 75% of sales of pieces, including amethyst, sea glass, and agates from her business, Cindy Lou, who too, based in Calgary, Alberta, come from Americans. But after trade talks between U.S. and Canada collapsed over the weekend, and leaders of both countries pledged to slap 50% tariffs on each other's products, business owners on both sides of the border are bracing for the fallout. With the majority of the items she sells falling under U.S. President Donald Trump's newly imposed tariffs, Baldassi says she will need to add 50% to the price of most of her products to stay afloat. It's quite likely that it will wipe out most of my U.S. sales, Baldassi told the BBC. I expect that at least half of my business will be gone. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has pledged levies starting on September 8th on U.S. steel, dairy, appliances, and electronics. Trump tariffs went into effect on Saturday, hitting Canadian wine, dairy, cement, clothing, and hockey equipment. In Canada, it is not clear how much more severe the impacts will be, since the country has grown somewhat used to the on-again, off-again trade war. Lind Furniture has been in business for almost 60 years in the Canadian province of Ontario, selling leather furniture to big store clients like Sears and Costco over the years. Sales dropped when Trump took office in 2025. As soon as there were tariffs in the air, people put purchases on hold, Michael Safer, general manager of Lind Furniture, told the BBC. Now his concern centers around Canadians' chances for victory. Everyone wants to sell to the Americans. They can buy from whoever they want, he said. I don't know that we're going to win a war with them. We may get killed. The U.S. tariffs that took effect after talks broke off on Friday apply to about 15 euros, pounds, 28 billion Canadian, worth of Canadian exports to the U.S., about 5% of what Canada ships to the U.S. annually. The levies add to U.S. tariffs already in place on Canadian steel, aluminum, automobiles, and lumber. Canada would be very exposed if the import taxes multiply on both sides, because 70% of its exports are to the United States. Navigating what comes next as both sides are dug in is proving a delicate balance for some business owners. Like many retailers, Mario Garmella, founder of Toronto-based menswear brand Outclass, told the BBC that his company collects orders from clothing designers months before they are due to arrive in stores. Products that U.S. stores ordered in January will arrive in September, but now with a new tariff. If I contact them now and tell them, hey, you know, we may get an extra 50% bill from the UPS on top of what you need to pay me for this shipment, they're all going to say, no way, don't ship it. He still has to figure out where that additional cost will go. There's going to be a lot of people that go out of business because of this, Gamarella said, but noted that only 20% of his wholesale sales and 20% of his e-commerce comes from the U.S. Big business can, you know, always find a way, but small businesses are going to get smashed by this. The impacts are not only being felt north of the U.S.-Canada border. Carney promised his tariffs hitting U.S. products in September, which will match Trump's dollar for dollar. Details of the countermeasures will be released in the coming days, he said. For Mike Roach and Kim Osgood, owners of Paloma Clothing, a clothing store in Portland, Oregon, that means preparing for one of their best-selling items to potentially increase sizably in price. Osgood creates designs that she has a Montreal-based company transfer onto pillows the couple sells in their store. These pillows are their best-selling gift item, retailing at $59. With the newly imposed tariffs, a normal markup would bring the price of that pillow to somewhere between $86 and $90. Gift items are really price point sensitive. People have in their mind what they're going to pay for a gift, and they're not going to pay more than that, Roach said. The couple, whose shop has been operating for 51 years, say they will likely hold the original price and hope the tariff problem, as Roach calls it, gets worked out. It would be one thing if we had 3 months' notice. That would be something you could plan around, do some work with the vendors. But when it happens literally overnight, you're really stuck, he said. While the tariffs could mean changes for the Paloma Clothing Company, other American companies are facing the same battle they have faced since Trump returned to office and began imposing his levies. Bill Easton, owner of Terry Rogue Wines in Plymouth, California, has been unable to ship his wine north to Canada for the past year and a half due to a boycott of U.S. alcohol. He is currently paying $2,400 a month to store that wine in a warehouse in the hope that he will one day be able to ship it to the Canadian markets he sells to. The wine has just gotten better in the warehouse, but I can't expect my customer in Canada to pay that extra cost that I've assumed over the last year and a half as part of the price. If I was able to sell it tomorrow, Easton told the BBC. And then there are the American businesses impacted by proximity to the Canadian border. The number of Canadian customers traveling across the border to shop at Heather Siva's craft shop, Northwest Yarns and Mercantile in Bellingham, Washington, has gone down some 20% since the tariff war began over a year ago. What has further irked Canadians has been Trump musing on Canada becoming a 51st U.S. state. The shop sits 25 minutes from the U.S.-Canada border, and since the war ensued, Seavers said her business received emails from Canadian customers saying they could not patronize her business due to anti-Canadian rhetoric. "We completely understood that," she said. But the combined impact of fewer customers and higher prices have left the shop asking for help from the community recently via a fundraising initiative to stay afloat. And then over the weekend, when the new tariffs struck, Siva's saw another hurdle appear. "It's going to get worse before it gets better," she said. "It's going to take years and years and years to get a relationship back with Canada. And I think those new tariffs are digging us deeper into a hole." And continuing with the tariff war, Carney faces crucial test after walking away from Trump's deal. The United States and Canada have entered into uncharted territory. The longtime allies and economic partners who have enjoyed free trade for decades are now in an escalating trade war with no clear off-ramp. And for Prime Minister Mark Carney, the late-night decision to suspend talks with President Donald Trump and to retaliate instead of agreeing to a deal that seemed in reach will be a significant political test. He is one of the first world leaders to walk away from the negotiating table with the White House, and the outcome will be closely watched. Both sides have blamed last-minute changes for torpedoing the tentative deal, with Carney saying the U.S. asked too much and offered too little. Carney's decision will challenge the appetite among Canadians to accept some economic pain as Ottawa pushes for more U.S. concessions. After rejecting Trump's high-pressure tactics and in choosing to hit back against the latest duties, Carney will need to convince Canadians that the economic pain is worth the cost of standing up to Trump in search of a better agreement in the long run. In remarks on Saturday, he said, "We take this step confident this is the best interest of Canada," and accused the U.S. of a power play by seeking 11th-hour changes. Asked by a reporter whether the U.S. and Canada were locked in a trade war, he replied, "You're at war when you're attacked. We got attacked." Switching to French, he said the spiraling trade dispute wasn't our choice, adding, "Canada is strong, Canada is ready, Canada is united." There is no doubt this will cause pain on both sides of the border, with business facing more pressure from U.S. duties and Canadian counter-tariffs. Canada sends about 70% of its exports to the U.S., and the country is the top trading partner for a number of U.S. states, with Michigan, Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio among the most exposed. Carney came to power with a call for elbows up, an ice hockey term for an aggressive approach, vowing to fight for Canada in the face of a Trump administration keen to exert economic pressure for its America First agenda. Many Canadians have told pollsters that they are willing to fight. A recent survey by Abacus Data suggested that around 36% of Canadians would support retaliating to U.S. tariffs, while a Legger poll indicated that 56% of Canadians want the federal government to take a hard line and make no concessions. Canadians are frustrated with the U.S. tariffs and have already chosen to avoid traveling there. A decision by most provinces to remove U.S. alcohol from store shelves have hammered that sector. Based on U.S. government trade data, U.S. wine exports to Canada fell 78% year over year, a $357 million loss in export value. The U.S. Distillers Association reported similar numbers, saying provincial bans have caused exports of American spirits to drop by more than 70%. The ban quickly became a point of frustration for the Trump administration. Canada's prime minister will also need to convince the provinces who have been less affected by the U.S. trade dispute so far that walking away is a risk worth taking. He briefed them on Saturday on the current state of affairs, and for now they are showing a united front. British Columbia Premier David Eby said he was committed to the national project we are on, while Ontario Premier Doug Ford said, "We didn't start this fight, but I can assure you we're going to win this fight." It's still unclear exactly how the talks fell apart in the final hours, but by all accounts it came down to the wire. Carney said that late U.S. proposed terms were unfair, uneconomic, and called into question the reliability of any deal. He added on Saturday those terms included demands on the automobile sector and unacceptable restrictions on trade deals with other countries. In one biting line, he said of the Trump administration, "We recognize sometimes its signature is written in pencil." U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer, meanwhile, pointed to new demands and walkbacks of other commitments by Canada. In a statement on Friday, the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States suggested Canadian provinces continued refusal to return U.S. spirits products to store shelves has led to this outcome. There were also reports by Canadian media that U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick was unhappy with the deal. The BBC has contacted his office for comment. And as details on an interim trade agreement with the U.S. trickled out over last week, some provincial leaders, industry groups, and political opponents raised concerns that the Prime Minister had not delivered on the fight he promised, though Carney denied that swayed his thinking. Ford, usually one of the most vocal Canadian politicians on U.S. tariffs, had been silent on the tentative deal all week. But in a letter sent to Carney, he raised concerns that an agreement under pressure would embolden the United States to seek concession after concession. The province, which has a large manufacturing and vehicle sector, has been among the hardest hit regions in this trade dispute. Conservative opposition leader Pierre Poilievre said that any agreement that included one-sided tariffs on Canadian industry would be a bad deal. On Saturday, he backed Carney's decision to walk away for now, saying Canada cannot accept one-sided tariffs that will de-industrialize our country. The collapse of this agreement calls into question the future of such talks, including an ongoing review of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Pact. Now Carney and Canada must wait to see how Trump responds. And from the arts section, whales were once more seen as monsters. Then came Moby Dick. Now 175 years old, U.S. author Herman Melville's classic is the ultimate tale of a man versus whale. But in fact, it questions why humans have been so terrified of the great sea creatures. Across time and place, we have seen animals as friends, collaborators, pests, gods, idols, and demons, and in our view of them is constantly shifting. In my new book, The Book of Beasts, Reclaiming Animal Wisdom, I trace the emotional story of our relationships with animals, and I reflect on how storytelling has impacted how we treat them. In many ways, our shared futures look bleak, with wildlife populations declining by 73% between 1970 and 2000. Yet the relationship between humans and one creature in particular, the whale, should give us hope. In ancient medieval times, whales were conflated with sea monsters and the devil, but now they're an animal many of us long to see and save. And one seminal moment in the whale's reappraisal came 175 years ago with the publication of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, an epic great American tale of man versus whale, whose tragic hero, Captain Ahab's fixation on the titular white sperm whale, leads to his death. The story is narrated by Ishmael, a sailor who joins Ahab's whaling mission, looking for money and adventure. On board, however, Ahab announces the real reason for the trip, vengeance. He wants to chase down and kill Moby Dick, who bit off his leg on a previous voyage. But Melville did not share Ahab's animosity for the sea creature. Instead, his story invites readers to question where human fears about monstrous animals come from, and whether those fears say more about us than them. The U.S. East coastal town of Nantucket, Massachusetts, where Moby Dick begins, became the whaling capital and earned its nickname, the City That Lit the World. The whalers learnt about whales through direct observation, while scientists had specimens to dissect. Taxonomy divided whales and other animals into neat categories based on anatomical differences and evolutionary history. finally, it seemed, humans had illuminated even the shadowy underwater realm. Yet some whales still challenge these ideas about the predictability of the natural world. On the 20th of November, 1820, a sperm whale struck down the Essex whaling ship in the southern Pacific Ocean. 20 men escaped on 3 boats, endured about 3 months at sea, succumbing to starvation and dehydration, and then, as 2 written survivor accounts tell it, eventually resorting to cannibalism. Among the survivors was senior crew member Owen Chase, whose account of what happened inspired Moby Dick. Certainly, the real-life tragedy and the great fictional story it inspired placed the very unlikely possibility of a whale attack in the collective imagination like never before. The odds of a whale striking a ship are close to zero. There are only around 5 historical cases. Whales avoid confrontation, and incidents such as the Essex sinking are now understood as accidental collisions or self-defense. But our fears, as Melville himself wanted to show, aren't always rational. As Ishmael narrates, Captain Ahab's irrationality is boundless. He seeks retribution against the whale who caused him such a great injury. His crew, he declares, must pursue Moby Dick around the world till he spouts black blood and rolls Finn out. The suggestion is that Ahab and other whalemen can kill whales until the cows come home. But if a whale fights back, their fury will be intolerable. In reality, perhaps the terror man felt towards the whale was more about his repressed fears about his own vulnerability. Owen Chase wrote this of the whale who struck the Essex. Quote, "I turned around and saw him, coming down apparently with twice his ordinary speed, and to me at that moment it appeared with tenfold fury and vengeance in his aspect." End quote. Ishmael is less certain that Ahab want the whale represent is what the whale represents, pivoting between fear and reverence. But he openly conflates the whale with the sea monster of the Bible, known as the Leviathan. The great Leviathan is that one creature in the world which God has created for the play of his own, he says. By the Middle Ages, Leviathan was explicitly identified as the whale by Christian figures like 13th century friar and philosopher Thomas Aquinas. Melville showed us the ancient monster, but also called this age-old framing into question, suggesting how the whale had become a receptacle for people's wider feelings about the unknown. For Ahab, the white male is an embodiment of chaos, indifference, and cruelty. Quote, "All visible objects are but as pasteboard masks," end quote, declares Ahab. He sees the physicality of the whale as a facade, concealing behind it a far greater malevolent force. Ahab longs to destroy the inscrutable thing beyond Moby Dick's mask. This inscrutable thing he is referring to is what he presumes is an evil power in nature. Call it the devil, God, or fate. Ishmael sees Ahab as loading the whale with the sum of all the general rage and hate felt by his whole race from Adam down. For millennia, we have associated the act of humans slaying beasts with heroism, and these narratives are hard to shake, even if the more courageous path is coexisting with them. Binary categorizations such as good and evil, whether applied to animals or fellow humans, are attempting escape from ambiguity. But these are something Melville and Moby Dick reject. Even among those whose job it was to see whales as a product of the time, whales were never one thing. Some whalemen referred to whales as monsters. Others grew sympathy or curiosity through direct observation. I cannot conceive anything more strikingly awful than the butchery of this tremendous Leviathan of the deep, wrote whaler J. Ross Brown in his 1846 book, Etchings of a Whaling Cruise. Two generations on from whaling's peak, whales now mean very different things to people. Reading Moby Dick, many contemporary readers root for the whale, not the whaler. In the last century, a changing economy has seen commercial whaling pared back, though it has not ended completely, despite international bans. Norway, Iceland, and Japan still whale for profit. And the mixture of fear and economic exploitation that characterize our relationship with whales in Melville's time has by and large been replaced by admiration and a desire to save them. Indeed, humans now embrace the idea of whales fighting back against human cruelty, even if we still don't know what they're doing. Our stories about it have changed. In the last few years, increased incidents of orcas, aka killer whales, ramming boats off the coast of Spain and Portugal, have come to be known on social media as an orca uprising, even though science does not yet have much evidence that their actions are intentionally hostile. A significant point on the whale's metamorphosis in the eyes of humans came in 1967, when American biologist Roger Payne recorded Whale Song, and humans were moved by it. Since then, a growing body of research shows whales are capable of complex communication, once believed unique to humans. Might whales also be able to reciprocate kindness? In my book, I relay reports of Vietnamese fishermen saved by whales, which has informed their folk religion, and spoke with Nan Hauser, a whale scientist who was saved by a whale humpback whale. Research from marine ecologist Robert Pittman has observed interspecies altruism among humpback whales, who save marine animals like seals from orcas. For all that is unknown, these accounts and studies validate the sense that whales have an inner world which might rival our own. Chase Coffin from Nantucket is a direct descendant of Owen Chase, and his family are proud of their whaling ancestry. Their feelings about whales, however, have shifted. My family now donates every year to save the whales, he says. I've been vegetarian most of my life. Melville showed us how we make our monsters from the fear and guilt we repress within ourselves. Looking beyond our own projections, we finally might glimpse the animal's real depths. And from the business section, good free fun. The simple formula that has made Duolingo a daily habit for millions. Perhaps no app has mastered user loyalty quite like Duolingo, the gamified language learning platform 34 million people a day can't put down. Here, CEO and co-founder Louis Van Aan tells the BBC why their insistent owl works so well. The day I started working on this story about Duolingo, it seemed to be everywhere. I heard from a friend who was celebrating her 800-day Spanish practice streak on the app. I read about a journalist from The Guardian who became addicted to learning Italian. A Sri Lankan waitress in Brooklyn switched from English to Spanish when she heard my mother and I speaking, crediting Duolingo for her skills. But my deep interest in the world's most downloaded language learning app truly began last year when I saw firsthand its significant impact on new migrants to the U.S., a country undergoing one of the largest migration waves of the decade. At some point in their long journeys, Duolingo becomes an essential tool for those people on the move. John Jario Ancampo, a former bus driver from Colombia, recalls struggling to find work in his first days in the U.S. in 2023, when a boss at a construction site in New York City explained simply, "More English, more money." He used Duolingo to learn. Now the family lives in Indianapolis, and John's wife is using the app to get along better at her job in an elementary school kitchen. She says her boss is using it, too, to learn Spanish. The migrant experience is not foreign to Duolingo's CEO and co-founder, Louis Van An, who was born and raised in Guatemala, a Central American country with over 55% of its population living in poverty. In a Latin American country, and in Guatemala in particular, if you have money, you can buy a very good education. But if you don't have money, sometimes you don't even learn how to read and write, Van Han told the BBC in a recent interview at Duolingo's brand new office in downtown New York. That made a big impression on me. So when non-native English speakers Van An and Severin Hacker, Duolingo's CTO and co-founder, started their company in 2012, they knew that learning languages, in particular learning English, has the potential to change people's lives. This is why we've worked really hard to keep Duolingo free, because we want to give access to education to everybody. To maintain the promise of an open and free app, Van An and Hacker developed a hybrid business model that combines ad-supported access and freemium elements, while also offering a paid subscription with extra benefits, like the ad-free experience and a family plan. And it worked. The main way in which we grow is by word of mouth, so people tell their friends, he says. One such word-of-mouth moment came from Bill Gates, who said in a Reddit chat back in 2015 that he regretted not speaking more languages and had tried Duolingo. In the intervening years, the app has found its way onto many, many screens. According to Duolingo's shareholder letter, in 2023, the company's revenue was $531 million. And the forecast for the full year, 2024, is $731 million. Roughly 8% of Duolingo users pay for a subscription, contributing to 80% of the company's revenue. Meanwhile, the vast majority, 90%, use the free version and see ads, which account for only 8% of the earnings. The app combines short, engaging lessons and game-like elements to help users develop speaking, reading, writing, and listening skills in 41 languages. Around half of the users are practicing English, and Duolingo can be used to learn other major world languages, like Spanish and Chinese, as well as some lesser-known languages such as Esperanto, Navajo, and even High Valyrian, a fictional language developed for HBO's Game of Thrones. There was some controversy last year when Duolingo paused its Welsh language course. The app now offers maths and music courses as well. To keep people coming back daily, Duolingo created a streak system and fashioned characters with strong personalities, such as the infamous Green Owl, Duo, and a goth purple-haired teen, Lily. These characters send daily practice reminders and, based on social media posts, are magnetic to users. The brand has taken advantage of Duo's popularity as evidenced by its TikTok videos, where it does very strange stuff, as Van An described. At first, it was just this owl. Then I think it started getting a life of its own when the notifications from the phone started coming from the owl. People started ascribing it a personality. And then I think people started memes for the owl, because the owl is very insistent, he added. Still, he sees the appeal. I cannot speak French to another person, but I can speak French to her, Van An says of Lily, opening his phone to demonstrate Duolingo's new product released at DuoCon this summer, which allows conversational practice. The CEO, who claims he is shy when speaking new languages, talks enthusiastically with the app in good French with a bumpy accent. He says he spends 30 minutes a day in the app and is also learning Swedish and Japanese. Most people are like me, he says, explaining why this is his favorite feature. When they're not very good at a language, they just don't want to speak to another person. So it's going to let people actually practice. Today, Duolingo serves 34 million daily users worldwide and employs 850 people across six cities: Detroit, Seattle, Berlin, Beijing, New York, and their headquarters in Pittsburgh, where you can discover the company's culinary spin-off, Duol Takira. This global presence affirms the company's accelerated growth. In October 2024, Duolingo's market capitalization was $12.27 billion, a significant rise from 2022 when its market cap was $2.85 billion. The CEO's journey to become a tech founder billionaire began when he was an 8-year-old boy in Guatemala City, where his single mother, a doctor, gifted him a computer instead of the Nintendo he had wanted. He left Guatemala in 1996 to study mathematics at Duke University. He went on to pursue a PhD in computer science, and it was during his first year at Carnegie Mellon University in 2000 when a pivotal moment occurred. The young doctoral student attended a talk in which Yahoo's head scientists shared 10 problems the company couldn't solve. At the time, Yahoo was the biggest internet company. It was huge. Yahoo gave free email accounts to people, and there were malicious people that were writing programs to obtain millions of email accounts, and they didn't know how to stop them. I went home, I thought about it, and came up, along with my PhD advisor, with the idea of a CAPTCHA. That is the distorted characters that people have to see online to prove that you're a human, he reveals. CAPTCHA, an acronym for Completely Automated Public Turing Tests to Tell Computers and Whom Humans Apart, served as the foundation for ReCAPTCHA, best known today as Google's I Am Not a Robot verification system. It was not only a technological improvement, but also a company founded and solely owned by Von Ahn. In 2009, Google acquired it for an undisclosed eight-figure sum, along with a game that helped improve the accuracy of Google image search. By his early 30s, Von Ahn had become a millionaire. Although this Louis von Ahn didn't become the mathematics teacher he dreamt of being as a teenager in Guatemala City, these milestones and the awards he has won along the way allowed him to create an educational platform that now lives in the pockets of millions worldwide. Here he tells the BBC more about his unputdownable app and how a self-proclaimed people pleaser gets by in the C-suite. Duolingo's free version is really good, and I think that matters. And the second one is that we early on understood that the hardest thing about learning something by yourself is staying motivated. So we have spent a lot of time making Duolingo fun. With Duolingo, it feels like you're playing a game as opposed to education apps, which are just trying to teach you something without engaging you. Gamification is probably the most important thing. We try to turn the whole thing into a game, but we try to use storytelling. From the beginning, I wanted to have a mascot. I thought it would make the whole thing more accessible. And having it doing weird things online really helps. But it's not like it started in one day. This is an evolution. It all works together to create a brand that people love. Most of the features we have now, we got it by trial and error. We've tried too many things that didn't work. The ones that are now there is because we tried them and they did work. And how do you create habituation? It really depends. People who are learning English, which they are half the users, generally actually want to learn English. They really care. The others, it's more of a hobby. If you take a user in the U.S. and you ask them, why are you using Duolingo? Very common answers, I used to play a lot of Candy Crush, or I used to look at a lot of Instagram, and now I'm doing Duolingo instead, and at least I'm learning a little bit of Spanish, or a little bit of German, or whatever. So it's kind of like a productive use of time. Even when apps and screen time can be seen as problematic, is your hope is that Duolingo is creating a positive habit? We want to be positive. When we decided to start teaching maths and music, there are two things that we thought are just positive. We may expand to other subjects, but we're going to try to continue doing things that are positive. We're unlikely to teach the Pokemon characters, for example. Many people want to learn that, but we just want to do things that are good for the world. We want parents to feel good about giving their kids this app. We want it to be the case that after you use the app, you feel like you did something good. Duolingo's website claims to have a diverse workforce from more than 30 countries. Why is that important for a platform like yours? We have a lot of international employees, and that's been really good. Sometimes you don't know what's going on in a certain country, and then an employee from the country tells us, the reason this is not working is because you translated that word wrong. Do you see a strange sentence often? Can you share an example? Most of our sentences are useful sentences, like, where is the bathroom? But some of them are just strange, and that has kept our virality. One that struck with me, I think it was in the Danish course, the sentence said, over there, behind the bed, lies the body of her husband. And it's like, what is that? What is that sentence? What is the most challenging part of being a CEO of a large company? I don't think we're very large. We are 850 people. Two things for me. When we were smaller, when we were like 50 people, everybody trusted me because they spent the time with me directly. And they're like, okay, he's a nice guy. Once I have more than, 300 people, I can't spend time with everybody. And so it's much harder for trust to happen. And a lot of times I have to make decisions that are not popular. Is it hard for you to tell people something that will hurt them? I am a people pleaser, and it's good and bad. I married a Swedish woman, and let me tell you, she's direct. In our culture, in Latin America, you're so indirect. In Guatemala, we just go around the subject and around the subject to try to make them understand, but never tell them. Whereas Swedish people are just like, I don't like you. And it's just like, wait, why are you saying that? We would never say that in Latin American culture. And lastly, do you think that an app like Duolingo could be becoming an alternative method for education on other skills more broadly? Yeah, I think you can learn other skills, but I don't think that an app will replace schools or universities. That's because schools and universities serve other purposes. Schools, for example, serve the purpose of childcare. In universities, you get to learn how to be an adult. But I do think you'll be able to learn almost everything in an app. Also, from a global standpoint, many people don't have access to a good teacher or a good education, so hopefully they'll be able to learn with this. Do you see Duolingo occupying that space? I would like that. I don't know if they'll be able to teach everything, but I would like that. And from the travel section, hiking Norway's heavily guarded Russian border. A series of scenic paths trace the Norwegian-Russian border, but as you trek through the tundra and forests, you may notice watchtowers and cameras hanging in trees. I'm standing at a hillside clearing in the tundra along the Russian-Norwegian border, watching the Pasvik River ripple and move below. Maybe it's the rustle of the birch leaves overhead or the buzzing sound of mosquitoes circling all around me, but I have an unshakable feeling that I'm being watched. Then again, those hairs on the back of my neck could be triggered by the nearby military watchtower and the fact that this public hiking trail is under constant surveillance. Located in the far reaches of northeastern Norway, on a jagged fjord close to where Finland, Russia, and Norway meet, the small town of Kirkenes is best known among the travelers as the final turnaround port for a number of small Arctic cruise lines. But increasingly, local operators are leaning into another opportunity, leaning cruisers on wind-whipped treks along NATO's most northernmost land border to the unfenced but heavily monitored long line separating Norway and Russia. Here, surrounded by taiga forest, travelers can explore a network of public trails where cameras hang in the trees, watchtowers dot the horizon, and military patrols ensure visitors are abiding by the periodic pillars. Yellow for Norway, red for Russia, marking the international boundary between the two nations. Drawn by the prospect of exploring Arctic's most closely watched frontiers, I've set out on a 3-hour trek through a birch forest strewn with boggy puddles. The trail runs parallel to the Pasvik River for roughly 1 kilometer before it reaches the border corridor, an 8-mile-wide strip of cleared forest that's a veritable no-man's land where travelers can't go. From there, the trek culminates in a scramble up Russell Olga, a hillside overlooking the Storskog border crossing that is the only legal land border between the countries. But we enter the forest. My guide, Henrik Hoffman, switches off his mobile phone to avoid connecting to Russian data networks. He instinctively taps a satellite phone in his pocket, and I'm reminded that this is no ordinary walk in the woods. Hoffman has been leading these border trek trips since 2025, but relocated to Kirkenes in 2021, just before Russia invasion of Ukraine a year later. Since then, he says that both Russia and Norway have increased security along their respective borders. Now, seemingly minor offenses, like throwing stones towards Russia, risk heavy fines, and wandering beyond the marked international boundaries has resulted in detainments. Still, he says that after traveling along Norway's coastline, many passengers who arrive on the cruises are eager to escape the confines of ships and shuttle buses and get an up-close look at where these two nations meet. Many older travelers are particularly interested because they remember the Cold War and have followed relations between Europe and Russia over many decades. Hoffman explains, the hike allows them to experience the landscape for themselves while learning about the history and present-day realities of living beside Russia. When Kirkenes Tours is the newest operator to offer border excursion, it's not the first. Havilia Voyages have been leading visitors to this area since 2000, while Herta Gruten told the BBC that its Norwegian border tour, which also leads travelers through a World War II atomic bomb shelter, recently became the most popular of its 8 Kirkenes excursions. Interest in the border has definitely increased over the past few years, says Hoffman. Despite an initial reduction in tourism following Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, he explained that understanding the border is now a driving motivator for those visiting Kirkenes. According to Anja Televaro Hansen, a destination manager at Visit Kirkenes, these border treks allow visitors to learn more about what everyday life in our region looks like and how the closeness to the border has shaped the Kirkenes region over the years. Evidence of this shared history is everywhere, and Kirkenes The town is the only place in Norway where street signs are marked in both Norwegian and Russian. Near the center, the towering Russia War Monument commemorates the day in 1944 when the Red Army liberated Kirkenes from Nazi occupation. And nearby Borderland Museum highlights how Norwegians, Finns, and Russians have intermixed here for generations. Along the Pasvik River, the border sharply juts west, surrounding the Boris Glebe Church. The Russian Orthodox Church dates to the 12th century and helped define the modern border here 200 years ago. Trekking the trail soon after landing at Kirkenes Airport, I was whisked into a van that cut through the city, past the port where cruisers had already docked for the day, and dropped off in an unassuming lay-by, flanked by dense wall of birch and conifer trees. "Ready?" said Hoffman, who was waiting in the lay-by with a rucksack, beckoning for me to follow along a stony track. An hour later, I'm stepping up a rocky outcrop as Hoffman nimbly picks the way ahead. As beads of sweat form on my forehead, I pause, taking in the eerie expanse of the birch trees dipping down towards the Pasvik River. Soon the outcrop slopes onto a flattened summit. Standing on Russian Hogan, surrounded by desolate tundra and a horizon of hazy peaks, I momentarily forget that I'm at one of Europe's most scrutinized borders, and I am consumed by the sheer beauty of the terrain. Then I glance to the right, notice a yellow and red set of markers only a few meters away, and sharply reminded where I am. Hoffman and I throw down a blanket on top of a smooth rock and sit for a drink. "There's Storskog," he says, gesturing towards two lakefront checkpoints below. From a few kilometers away, I can just make out the occasional truck driving along the E-105 to cross into Russia. He says that the recreational crossings have reduced, but a handful of vehicles still make the journey on a daily basis. He also explains that while more visitors are trekking these border trails, fewer residents are. Hoffman has seen more military patrols than local hikers. "You don't see many Norwegians here," he says. Perhaps it's a classic case of not exploring your own doorstep. As we turn away from Storskog and descend Russia Hoga, I find myself silenced by the gravity of the experience. I've spent a lifetime crossing borders and collecting stamps, but I could have sat for hours looking out at Storskog. From painted markers to distant outlines of Boris Glebe Church, centuries of politics and negotiations have shaped this terrain. It's easy to understand why more and more cruise passengers are disembarking to witness it firsthand. And lastly, from the sports section, England dropped Kars after nightclub incident. Pace bowler Bryden Kars has been removed from England's squad for the second test against Pakistan amid an ongoing investigation into an incident that led him to being handcuffed by police. Images that appeared on social media on Sunday show Kars, 31, in handcuffs outside a bar in Derby on Saturday night. The England and Wales Cricket Board has referred the incidents to the cricket regulator. The regulator will investigate, and as a result, Kars has been removed from the squad and replaced by Sony Baker. It is the latest in a string of off-field incidences involving the New England team. Kars has become the third player this summer to miss a test because of disciplinary issues. Bryden Kars will no longer be available for selection for the second men's test while this investigation is ongoing and the full facts are obtained. From the cricket regulator, Kars was part of the England squad for the first test against Pakistan, which the hosts won by innings inside 3 days. On the day before the test against Pakistan, players to be really good role models and good human beings. You always want to represent your country in the best possible light, New England captain Joe Root said. We might have fallen short on that on a few occasions in the recent past. The only thing we can do to rectify that is be really good role models, good human beings, and put in really strong performances in the field. And in other sports news, DeChambeau proud of what LIV has achieved. Bryson DeChambeau says he's proud of what LIV Golf has achieved as the breakaway league faces questions about its future following the final event of this season in Indianapolis. The league, which launched in 2022 as an alternative to the PGA Tour, has faced an uncertain future since Saudi Arabia withdrew its financial backing in April. Last week, its season-ending team championships in Michigan was canceled, meaning the event in Indianapolis concluded the 2026 campaign. LIV Golf CEO Scott O'Neill has said new investors have been secured for next season, but has been tight-lipped on the league's future plans and structure. American DeChambeau has led a selection of star players in joining LIV Golf 4 years ago and said although the breakaway league has not been perfect, it has a lot of potential moving forward. It has been an interesting ride, that's for sure. Everything we've gone through and the tough moments we've had, it's made us stronger, said DeChambeau. As much as we are transitioning from LIV 1.0 to LIV 2.0, I have great thoughts about what could happen next year. I wish I could be more upfront about it. Ultimately, I am proud of the fact that what we've done, the good and some of the bad that we've unfortunately had, that things have occurred. I'm going to be real with it. Not everything was perfect. But for the most part, we've done a solid job. And if there's one thing I could say, we did something different in the game of golf. And I'm proud of that. At the end of the interview, DeChambeau added, I think there's something fun coming. Last week, Rory McIlroy said it could be a tough road back to the PGA for those who leave LIV Golf. American rookie Michael Lissacio pipped Rahm to win the event in Indianapolis, carding a final round 65 to finish 18 under par. Rahm finished one shot behind a 17-under, which DeChambeau and Spain's Sergio Garcia tying for third a further shot back. Lissacio, 22, executed a perfect chip on the final hole before tapping in a birdie. It remains to be seen how LIV Golf 2.0 moves further with their new investors. And that is all the time we have for today for BBC Live, and I thank you for listening to the Talking Information Center for August 24th, 2026.